Good mornings. I'm Chris Oakes, and coming up today, the bad news with a dramatic drop-off in the available blood supply and an even steeper than normal drop-off in donations this summer, the American Red Cross has declared an emergency blood shortage. The good news? Fixing it is pretty easy. Also this morning in our Throwback Thursday segment, Team USA's round of 16 exit from the World Cup left many pointing the finger at our youth development program as the reason America lags behind in the global game. But the issues with youth sports in the U.S. run much deeper. And in our community and business spotlight, while the rest of us are still in full summer mode, the United Way of Hancock County is already preparing for the kickoff of their fundraising campaign this fall. This is the Good Mornings Podcast Edition for Thursday, July 16th, 2026. So I know you heard about this story yesterday because it was all over the news. The U.S. House this week passed the Sunshine Protection Act. It is a measure that would allow states to opt out of the twice-yearly time change and adopt either standard time or daylight saving time on a permanent basis. And the big change here is that right now, if a state were to decide not to change their clocks in the spring and fall, by law, they must remain on standard time. And many people would prefer to stay on daylight saving time instead. So this law would give states that option. So you could continue to change, you could stay on standard time, or you could stay on daylight time. And this was an idea. I was all for this at first when it, you know, my knee jerk reaction is this is a great thing, is I love to stay on daylight time year round. But I want to share something that actually Connor Prince posted the other day. He is the chief meteorologist at hometown stations in Lima, the TV stations there. And he pointed out that if we were to stay on daylight saving time year round, in late December, by the time we get into the winter hours, sunrise would not happen until nearly 9 a.m., 9 o'clock in the morning before the sun comes up, and it would still set a little after 6 p.m. So it's not like, we would get an extra hour, but you're talking 5 p.m. to 6 p.m. is not that, you know, that doesn't seem like that, but 9 a.m. for the sunrise. Now, part of that is because we are in the on the westernmost edge of the Eastern time zone. Like, for example, in New York, which, again, same time zone, but further east, and the sun comes up about 45 minutes earlier. And in the dead of winter there, it can actually get dark by like 4:30 in the afternoon. So permanent daylight saving time would hit a little different on the East Coast. But not to see the sun until 9 a.m.? Wow. And here's the other thing to consider on this. We could end up with a hodgepodge of different times of day within the same time zone. I mean, like Ohio might be on permanent daylight time. Kentucky might be on permanent standard time. Michigan might continue to change the clock twice a year. So it would be a real mess trying to figure out what time it is, you know, even within the same time zone. So this could get very complicated very quickly, very confusing, you know. Now, look, I hate changing the clocks as much as the next guy. It is a hassle, and I get it. But I wonder if this is one of those things where be careful what you ask for, because I'm not sure that the end result is going to work out quite the way people are hoping it will. You know what I mean? The legislation, by the way, passed the House this week, now heads to the Senate. And we don't really know how the Senate might vote on this. Back in 2022, the Senate passed a similar version of the bill, but it was not taken up in the House. And so now it's reversed. We'll see how that goes. If it passes Congress, the president has expressed his support. So it will probably be signed into law if both houses of Congress pass the measure, but we'll see. We'll see. And then it won't be automatic. States would have to then make the decision as to how they want to handle the time change. So might be different from one state to the next, but stay tuned. I'm just not quite so sure. I'm not quite so sold on it as I was immediately once I actually start thinking about it. I guess we did this. I read a piece in Newsweek yesterday. I guess we did this back in the early 70s. And people initially were all in favor of it. But then once they went through that first winter of the sunrise not happening until like 9 a.m., they were like, I'm not sure about this. And they scrapped it. So I don't know. Maybe it'll be history repeating itself. We'll see. Some of the other most interesting and buzzworthy stories to get your Thursday morning started. You remember yesterday we had a couple of interesting lists. Have another one here. The consumer advice website WalletHub is out this week with its rankings of the best American cities for recreation. The best American cities for recreation. They looked at 100 of the largest U.S. cities, and they considered statistics in 47 different metrics, including, and this is just a small sample, the number of public beaches, fishing spots, restaurants per capita, costs associated with enjoying such activities, and the quality of parks and playgrounds. So, based on all of that, all 47 metrics, Las Vegas came in first as the best American city for recreation, followed by Orlando. So, no big surprise, the best cities for recreation, Las Vegas and Orlando, right? But guess what city came in third? Cincinnati, Ohio. What? Cincinnati, Ohio, that's right. On the strength of its quality of parks ranking, which was seventh overall, and cost of entertainment, in that metric, Cincinnati was number one nationwide. They landed at number three overall on the list. So if you can't go to Vegas, you can't go to Orlando, you can go to Cincinnati and have just as fun of a time recreating, apparently. By the way, Jersey City, New Jersey ranked dead last. So again, kicking New Jersey, that's what they always do. Everybody dumping on New Jersey. We have the air quality alert today that we have to deal with, the wildfire smoke. Have you been following the stories of all of the rain that they have gotten in the southern U.S. over the past month? Still more flooding expected in Texas, even into the day today. Throughout the south, the past month has been incredibly wet. To give you an idea of how wet it has been, a backyard weather volunteer in central Louisiana caught a once-in-a-thousand-year rainfall record. NASA highlighted Matt Carnicle's history-making measurement this week after state and National Weather Service meteorologists inspected his rain gauge and confirmed the reading. 29.06 inches in just under 12 hours. 29 inches in 12 hours happened on June 18th as the remnants of Tropical Storm Arthur moved across the state. 29 inches in 12 hours. That's just hard to imagine. That's like rainfall of biblical proportions there. Once the reading is officially certified, it will go down as the wettest day in state history. And I got to think by a long shot, you know? That is amazing. 29. Can you imagine if we got in Hancock County, if we got 29 inches in under 12 hours? Forget flood mitigation. Ain't no mitigating that flood. That would be apocalyptic. Yeah. And one other item here among the most interesting and buzzworthy stories of the day. Maybe you're interested in this, maybe you're not, but former President Biden is set to release a new memoir. It's called Promise Me America, which will offer a reflection on his single term in the White House. The former president posted a video on X stating that the book is about the challenges we faced as a nation. It's about the decisions I made and why I made them. The ones that he can remember, anyway. The memoir, I'm just kidding. The memoir will offer his first-person account of the defining moments of his presidency and his decision to drop out of the 2024 election due to pressure and concerns about his health. Promise Me America, scheduled to hit store shelves on November 17th, just weeks after the midterm elections. So, if you're interested. There you go, some of the most interesting and buzzworthy stories to get your Thursday morning started.
WFIN News, I'm Matt Demchek. Your WTOL 11 weather. Partly sunny today with a high in the 90s. Partly cloudy tonight, low in the 70s. Hancock Public Health says a bat has tested positive for rabies locally, serving as an important reminder for everyone to take precautions to protect themselves and their families from exposure to bats. The health department says bats are the leading cause of rabies deaths in people in the United States. And unfortunately, you can't tell if a bat has rabies just by looking at it. It must be confirmed in a laboratory. The health department says if you've been in contact with a bat, get a hold of the health department to discuss your rabies exposure risk and whether or not treatment is recommended. People with a pet who may have been exposed to a bat should contact their veterinarian for further instructions. Get more in this story on our website. A controversial proposed blanket permitting process for data center water discharge is being reviewed by the Ohio EPA.
The debate over data centers in Ohio continues. The centers house large servers to support data in the cloud, AI, and more. Supporters say they could bring jobs, tax revenue, and investment, but critics are worried about impacts to the environment, property values, and energy use. And now the Ohio EPA is reviewing more than 7,000 public comments submitted over the past 8 months. The environmental group proposed a new statewide permit for water discharge from those data centers.
WTOL 11 Sophia Perricone reporting. Get more on our website. By now, you probably noticed the Walk Your Wheels markings on sidewalks in the downtown district in Findlay. The city says the markings are intended to provide additional awareness and guidance in portions of the downtown where pedestrian traffic is the heaviest. City officials say as Findlay's downtown continues to grow and attract more visitors, the goal is to strike a balance between all users of the public right-of-way, pedestrians, cyclists, e-bike riders, scooter users, and motorists alike. Get more details in this story on our website. Remember, you can always get more news anytime at WFIN.com.
So our cover story this morning, we have some good news and some bad news. The bad news is that with a dramatic drop in the available blood supply and an even steeper than normal drop-off in donations this summer, the American Red Cross has declared an emergency blood shortage. The good news is that fixing this problem is pretty doggone easy. Joining us this morning is Todd James in the North Central Ohio chapter of the American Red Cross, along with Micah Alt, Biomedical Services account manager. And Todd, this is something that we have talked about before, the importance of blood donations, because there's no substitute. There's no such thing as synthetic blood. It is what it is, and it is the only thing that will work for this purpose.
That's exactly right. And it's not something that we can, hold on to. It has a very limited shelf life.
That's the other thing.
Rocket. Yeah. And even if we could, I don't think there's ever been a time when we would have enough to stock it, because pretty much as soon as it goes on the shelf, so to speak, hospitals need it. And as you said, we're seeing an increase in demand well above what was expected this summer from our hospitals, at the same time that we always usually do see a decrease in donations over summer because of schools being out, college students going home, people traveling for vacations, summer schedules. So we already see people not necessarily making time in their summer schedule to give blood like they might during another part of the year. Mm-hmm. But with an increase at the level that we're seeing from hospitals and the drop off in the supply in June, we're in an emergency situation right now.
And so it's kind of a double whammy. Very same things that keep people away from the blood donor drives are the things that in many cases lead to an increased demand. People are going on vacation, which means there are more accidents. There are more, things like that. You get hit on both ends. And this is a national issue. This is a national blood emergency. It's not just something, here in our area.
No, it's countrywide. This is an issue that we're facing across the entire country, including right here at home. So it's important that we step up and make our appointments and make our donations.
So what happens when there is not enough blood what happens next?
Well, basically surgeries are canceled or put on the back burner. Mm-hmm. And we go out and look for that blood where we can, and we host as many blood drives as we possibly can to collect that blood for those hospitals and patients.
The bottom line is that, as you mentioned, some people who need care are not going to be able to get it in as timely a manner, elective surgeries or, surgeries that may have to be postponed and so on, because emergencies obviously are going to always take priority. So this has a trickle-down effect beyond just the emergency issue where that's concerned. So, Micah, talk a little bit about what is involved. I mean, this is one of the things that a lot of people don't give blood because of the fear of the unknown. So let's pull back the mask on that a little bit, if you will, pull back the curtain. What is involved? How long does it take? Kind of lay this out for us, for those who have not done it before.
Generally, it takes about an hour out of your day. Now, if you pick a blood drive that gets a little more heavy traffic, it might be a little bit more time. But we put all sorts of things in place to make sure that we can get you in and out of there as fast as we can through Rapid Pass, where you can fill out your health history questions prior to even showing up to the blood drive. I don't know if you've ever given blood in the years past. You'd have to come in, sit down in the booth, answer all your questions. You can now do that with Rapid Pass. Once you arrive, you're going to register. You're going to wait for probably a minute or two, and then they're going to call you back to give a small physical. You will get your hemoglobin tested and your blood pressure just to make sure that all is well. They'll download all your questions, kind of go over those questions to make sure everything is that you're healthy that day and you can give blood. And once that is done, you'll go over to the bed. And this is where everyone gets kind of scared because are going to get poked with a needle. But it's just a small poke. And I always like to think about what are other people going through, the pain that they are suffering, I have to get poked for a second and it might, I might cringe, but so at that point, you're probably on the bed less than 10 minutes, depending on how fast you can fill the bag. We also have other donation types where we call power reds. And that's when you are able to, if you are the right type, which is O positive, O negative, A negative, and B negative, we can collect 2 units of red blood cells from you, and then you only have to give every 112 days, where if you give a whole blood donation, we ask you to give every 56 days. As Todd mentioned earlier, blood has a shelf life. So every month we're out there collecting.
Yeah.
Once you fill the bag, then you go to a canteen and you have your snacks and usually collect a t-shirt or some kind of incentive or something fun.
And one of the things that I know has happened in recent years is that the technology, the medical advancements have made it possible for more people to give blood than maybe used to be, at a minimum, discouraged from it. You can pretty much anyone can donate these days.
Yes. So there's been lots of changes. You'll hear from some of the older population that, oh, they don't want my blood because I was in England at such and such a time because of mad cow or whatever travel restrictions might be. So I encourage everyone to go to redcrossblood.org and look those up, because things have changed. Yeah. And there's lots of people out there that can give blood that don't give blood because of past issues that we had on.
Yeah, maybe they've been turned away before, and that may not be
the
case.
I think I've shared this statistic with you before, Chris, but I think it does drive it home, really, that about 30% of the U.S. population is eligible to donate blood. Of that 30%, about 10% does. So it's a very small population who are supplying the blood supply of the United States.
Yeah, and even 30% sounds like a small number, but that's triple the amount of people that we have right now. And imagine if, you know, we tripled the number of donors who came out to all of these blood drives. We would not be talking about a national blood emergency right
now. That's right.
So you've got upcoming blood drives all over the area, wherever people may be hearing us talk. You do have blood drives coming up. And really, as you mentioned, Micah, the easiest way to get all of this started, get the process started, is to find the blood drive and start filling out the questionnaires. You can do all of that online, right?
Yes. Redcrossblood.org will, and then there's a prompt right away where you can put in your zip code and find all the blood drives that are in your area.
And if folks want to host a blood drive, maybe an organization, a business, what have you, is hearing us talk, and you, I know you're always searching for places to host blood drives because you can never have enough in that respect. How do they go about doing that?
I would say the best way would be to contact either Micah or myself.
Okay.
Again, you can reach out to us through the chapter, through me. I can put you in touch with Micah. There's a lot, you know, this could be a whole show in itself, and we should do it someday. There's a lot involved with hosting a blood drive, a lot more than people think. But there are ways to get involved by sponsoring our an already existing blood drive, getting your employees and your customers there. So if you're interested in helping us make a successful blood drive in the community, we'd love to talk to you. Give me a call. You know, you've got our office number. Our information's on your website, or you can email me, todd.james@redcross.org, and we'd love to talk to you about what you can do to help us with that.
Again, it is a nationwide emergency blood shortage from the American Red Cross. So if you have ever thought about giving blood and you haven't, or you haven't for a long time, now would be the perfect time, because this is an issue that is pretty doggone easy to address when you really get down to it. Again, Todd James with the North Central Ohio chapter of the American Red Cross, and Micah Ault, the Biomedical Services Account Manager, with us this morning. Thank you both for taking the time.
Thanks,
we appreciate
Chris.
It.
Thank you.
Well, Team USA's round of 16 exit from the World Cup just a couple of weeks ago left many pointing the finger at our youth development program as the reason America lags behind in the global game. But the issues with youth sports in this country run much deeper. I mean, there's a lot to love about youth sports, but there is also a darker side. Linda Flanagan is a freelance journalist, former youth coach, founding member of the New York City chapter of the Positive Coaching Alliance, and advisory board member for the Aspen Institute's Reimagining Sports Initiative. She is also the author of the book Take Back the Game: How Money and Mania Are Ruining Kids' Sports and Why It Matters. In it, she sheds light on that unsavory side of the youth sports industry, and at a very minimum, gives us a lot to think about. Back in September of 2022, we spoke to her about the book. It is today's Throwback Thursday.
That's really what it has become, an industry. We talk about the youth sports industry. How did that happen? How did we let that happen?
Well, it started in the 70s when we cut funding for public parks and public facilities for kids to play in. There was a surge then of participants in the 90s, mainly girls who were now liberated to play after Title IX was enacted. And then in 1997, Walt Disney World built its Wide World Sports Complex because it shrewdly recognized that parents would spend on their kids and that they would travel with their kids to, you know, a wonderful place with wonderful hotels and parks at the ready. And when the Wide World Sports Complex became so successful, other municipalities caught on and built their own complexes. So now we have 30,000 of these around the country. And, you know, there's just it's kind of an endless appetite among parents to spend on their kids' sports, to develop their kids' athleticism. So that's one reason. That's one reason why we got where we are.
So many implications here. Talk about the fact, the way that this affects kids themselves. I mean, you have the risk of a hyper-competitive environment, not only how that impacts a child's enjoyment of a sport, but the impact it has on their psyche. There's the physical impact. This pressure to perform can lead to overtraining, and that has both mental and physical ramifications. So many implications here for the kids themselves, who ostensibly are the ones who are supposed to be having fun.
Right. Well, you know, I think one of the bottom lines of my book is that sports have moved away. You know, they're not almost about kids anymore. They're about the adults. They're about the parents and the coaches who are, you know, getting their reflected glory from the children. It's not about the kids' fun anymore. And one of the most telling stats that I uncovered was discovered by Travis Dorsch at the Families and Sports Lab at Utah State. And he found that the more parents spend on their kids' sports, the less kids enjoy it and the more pressure they feel. And, you know, so it's just an irony because we're, of course, as parents spend more and more, the kids enjoy it less. And there, again, as you say, there are these physical and emotional implications.
And what are we chasing after, really? I mean, what are we chasing after? I mean, I think we used to think that we need to, as parents, we need to keep ourselves in check, that we are not living vicariously through our kids. And you mentioned that that is still one concern, but it has evolved and morphed into something much more than that.
Right. Well, you know, I think one of the most fascinating things to look at is how is it that parents have that children have moved, as Jennifer Senior put it, from our employees to our bosses. There's been this shift in the last few decades so that, you know, like I'm sure your parents loved you and my parents loved me, but they didn't necessarily devote every weekend and waking free moment to cultivating my skills, whether athletic or otherwise. There was just a different understanding of what parents owed their kids. And this has shifted since the 70s when there's sort of this national mood took over where it's responsibility of individuals and families to look after themselves, forget about the community. So therefore it became a function, a parent's responsibility to ensure that their kid had every advantage. And then as a result, if the child did well, it reflected well on you. So this has also insinuated itself into sports.
And when you have that kind of environment that we have somehow created consciously or subconsciously, it also tends to attract some of the least desirable people and least desirable behaviors in people, whether we're talking about coaches, those who run the leagues and run the tournaments, and even parents and the behavior of parents. I know everyone has seen examples of that at one time or another.
Yes. I mean, that's kind of what also baffled me in my research is, you know, seeing parents who are, you know, otherwise like responsible, intelligent adults with jobs and maybe mortgages, just absolutely losing it at games. And it just tells you there's a lot, there's so much at stake here that is, it's way beyond the kids' fun is like completely beside the point. It's about, there's something, some kind of primal connection to the child and what that child is, how that child reflects on you. And, you know, I do think I should add, I think most parents start out, when you start getting your kids in sports, it doesn't start out of some kind of, you know,
right,
drive to satisfy your ego.
I think every parent starts out saying, I've seen the way other parents behave. That's not going to be me. But then the next thing you know, you turn around and hey, it is me. So, and this is one of the other things that I wonder, then how can we find that proper equilibrium? Because this is not an indictment of kids and sports. I mean, you're not an anti-sports, kids shouldn't be playing sports. Like we said, there is a lot to love youth sports. So how do we find that proper balance?
Well, you know, I offer four basic pillars for parents to kind of cling to try to help them navigate through this. The first is to look at your child and let them be the ones calling the shot on their sports participation. It really needs to come from them. Every expert in this field will tell you it has to come from the child. At the same time, you can offer a lot. You can encourage a variety of sports. You know, don't settle on just one or try to get them to play one, but offer a variety and let the kids kind of decide where they want to go. The other is to keep your family close. I think parents need to remember that the youth sports industry, the leagues and teams, it's not that they're bad people running them, but they don't care about your family. I mean, the bottom line is they don't care about your family. You have to look after it.
But yeah.
Stay local as long as possible. That's another thing.
I often wonder, and I, in full disclosure, and I think most people who listen regularly to the show know this because I've mentioned it, I am a youth sports official, and I have at all levels from the grassroots level up to the highest levels of youth sports. I've been to ESPN's Wide World of Sports a number of times for events there and so on, and sometimes I ask myself, am I part of this giant cog that is ruining youth sports? Am I sort of enabling this? And again, we talk about the industry. This is a bigger industry than the NFL. I mean, more money is involved in the youth sports industry than the NFL. So how do we, again, make sure that we don't become just another cog in that machine?
I think it requires you to ask yourself some hard questions. What are we doing here? What are we doing? Why are we doing this? I think officials, I have a sympathy for officials who are out there on the field getting targeted by, targeted, berated, and humiliated by furious parents. So I wouldn't condemn you for that. And as we know, there's now a shortage of
another example officials. Of what we were talking about earlier.
Yes, the craziness on the sidelines. But I think, again, if you can't fix all the world's problems, but you can try to like look at your own family and figure out, is this helping our family? Is this good for my son or daughter to be, playing this much? Are they getting hurt? Are they unhappy?
And I think that's the other thing.
Well, and I was just going to say also, how are the other siblings?
Yeah. That's a good point as well, because I think one of the other things that we struggle with is that we don't want our kids to be left behind when we see all of these other kids that are participating and supposedly having so much fun and having more opportunities. We don't want our kids to be left behind. So many things. We could talk about this all day, but it is a fascinating book. Take Back the Game is the title. Linda, thanks very much for taking the time. We appreciate it.
All right. Thanks for having me.
From September of 2022, our conversation with Linda Flanagan, author of the book Take Back the Game, How Money and Mania Are Ruining Kids' Sports and Why It Matters. We have a link to the book at our webpage. Go to goodmornings.net. It is today's Throwback Thursday.
This is Good Mornings with Chris Oakes on 1330 WFIN, WFIN.com, and 95.5 FM.
A Maryland man leading off the broken news this morning in big time trouble after first he stole a 3-month-old kitten from a pet store before allegedly attempting to rob a nearby bank with the cat still in his arms. Whole thing started around 10:30 in the morning when the unidentified suspect snatched the kitten named Magnolia. We know the name of the kitten, not the name of the suspect. Snatched Magnolia the kitten from the adoption area of a Pet Supplies Plus store in Beltsville, Maryland, and then ran directly to a PNC Bank branch in the same shopping center. Once there, he handed the kitten to an employee before passing a note to a teller demanding cash. Here, hold this. Hold this while I make a withdrawal. I don't know if he figured he'd distract them from the robbery. He said, oh, what a cute kitten, that they wouldn't even notice he was robbing the place. I have no idea. Police in Prince George's County arrested the man at the scene. They go on to report that Magnolia was unharmed, and the store says she is still looking to be legally adopted by a law-abiding citizen. That's crazy. Not to be outdone, a Mississippi man is facing a weapons charge after allegedly driving to U.S. Capitol barricade with a gun in his lap. Again, like they wouldn't notice. Police arrested 67-year-old Wendell Royster on Monday at the North Barricade at the U.S. Capitol near Constitution Avenue after he stopped his rented car to ask a guard for directions to the Supreme Court. Obviously, the officer spotted the handgun in his lap, and authorities immediately surrounded the vehicle to take the man into custody. He's probably still wondering, what did I do wrong? How did my genius plot fail? He will be enjoying an extended stay in Washington, D.C. to face some pretty serious charges. And finally, in the broken news this morning, the sheriff's office in St. Johns County, Florida, reports that on July 4th, they pulled over a moving vehicle traveling on the highway, launching fireworks from the passenger window. I mean, I love fireworks as much as the next guy, but not being launched out of a moving vehicle on the highway. When deputies made contact with the suspects, the occupants of the vehicle denied any involvement in shooting the fireworks until they were informed that their genius idea had actually been caught on camera. Then they fessed up. The vehicle occupants may not be celebrating their independence for much longer, since they were arrested and charged for shooting a deadly missile from a moving vehicle. Yeah, don't do that. Don't do that. What is it about fireworks that makes people completely take leave of their senses sometimes? There you go. That is today's broken news report. An update on the odd and unusual side of the headlines. We now return you to your regularly scheduled programming.
Want local sports? We've got lots of it at the WFIN Sports Archive. Play or download the Coach's Corner shows, plus games from your favorite teams, the Finley Trojans, the BBC, and Ottawa Glendorf. You have the power of local sports at your fingertips with the Sports Audio Archive. Check it out by clicking Game Audio Archive under the Sports tab at WFIN.com.
Now your daily download, the numbers behind the news and the statistics that shape our lives. I think most parents are worried, constantly worried about the impact that technology is having on their kids. Well, maybe you should be just as concerned about the impact it is having on you. New survey finds that parents are losing 7 hours of sleep per week, or 48 nights of lost sleep per year, largely due to technology-related worries. This is a study of 2,000 parents found nearly three-quarters of those parents reported that their child already owns a smartphone, including 47% of parents of five-year-olds.
Wow.
Parents with smartphone-owning children lose nearly two additional hours of sleep a week. The top concerns that are keeping parents awake at night, 24% cite their kids' screen time habits. 20% worry about social media's impact on their kids' self-esteem, and 18% worry about a gaming addiction. Now, despite those concerns, 76% of the parents in the survey still prioritize emergency contact ability, being able to get a hold of our kids in an emergency, being able to get in touch. That's the reason we do it. Despite all these fears, over three quarters of the parents in the survey said that they would prefer to find a device that stays connected while limiting distractions. Well, yeah, if you could figure that out, you could be a very rich person. A lot of people try to figure out where that sweet spot is.
Now, the Good Mornings Community and Business Spotlight.
Once again, putting the United Way of Hancock County in the spotlight this morning. And joining us this time around is United Way Resource Development Director, Kaya Yater. Kaya, first of all, let me ask, what exactly does a Resource Development Director do for the United Way?
It's a really fancy way of saying I run our campaign and plan our event.
Aha. Okay. So what resources are you developing right now?
Well, all of them. I just want to highlight. Right now, we, in partnership with City Apparel and Merch, are working on, they're hosting Do Good Thursdays every Thursday. Okay. They're truly a philanthropic team, and we're just really grateful for their support and to have them in our community. But every Thursday, they host a local food truck, and a portion of those sales goes back to our Halt Hunger initiative. So today is the Greek Garden. So from 11:30 to 1:30, we invite people to come out to City Apparel and Merch on West Main Cross and try out a new food truck that you maybe have wanted to try for a while and give back to the community at the same time.
Absolutely. That's a win-win all the way around. Now, how long does this run through the summer? Is it into the fall?
So they run through August. So the last one, I believe, is August 27th. And each week it's a different food truck.
Okay. So circle that on the calendar, because that is, like you said, a great way to give back to the community in such an important initiative. We've talked about it many, many times, that is really doing good. And again, you can see the tangible results of that in the community.
Yeah, and they can see the full schedule on our Facebook page.
Okay, very good. We are coming up on campaign season. You referenced that a little bit earlier. Before you know it, it's going to be time to kick that off. And once again, you're doing a kickoff event. It is a big pickleball tournament this year.
Yes, our pickleball tournament is on September 10th at 4:30 at the Riverside Courts. It's a fun way to kick off our campaign and support our mission, but it has truly grown into quite the tournament. So this year, we're going to have two different brackets. So participants will self-rank themselves and then get placed into the respective bracket. So whether you've never touched a pickleball paddle in your life or you play multiple times a week, it will be a really fun tournament for you. And just want to give a special shout out to State Bank. They're going to have their gifts truck there again this year, offering refreshments to players and spectators. We invite everybody's families to come out and watch. And they give out popsicles, which is just really fun. And it's also, a really warm evening in September usually. So, really grateful to State Bank again for that. Registration is open now at uwhancock.org, or they can find more information on our Facebook page again.
Okay. Again, not thinking too much about September at this point, but you definitely want to put that on your radar. And as you mentioned, folks can actually sign up. Now, is there a limit to the number of teams?
There's not, especially with two brackets being open. Okay. There's continuous play time in the way that it's structured. There's not really a limit.
All right. Yet. So gather your friends and coworkers, put together a team for that. And with respect to the campaign this year, like we said, that's kind of the kickoff event. And what can you tell us about the campaign itself? I'm guessing that that's kind of beginning to take shape on your end.
Yeah, so our annual campaign runs from September through November. The cool thing about our campaign, I just want to remind everybody, is that everything that's raised here stays here in Hancock County and gets put to work at helping our neighbors. Our mission remains the same, is to measurably improve lives in Hancock County. And our message this year is a little bit different, but it's simple. If you want to get involved in our community, United is the way. If you want to give back to our community, United is the way. United is the way to working together to solve our community's greatest challenges. And we can really make a huge difference. And we do every year because we all come together and work together. So
is there a goal this year? Or have you gotten that far to set a goal for the campaign for this coming year?
Yeah, so our goal, again, this year, just like last, is $1.9 million. Mm. And that stays right here in Hancock County and gets put to work to help one in four people, which is incredible. And, you know, there's a lot of work to be done, but we're going to make it happen.
Yeah. How cool would it be to eclipse the $2 million mark this year? That would be.
It would be really awesome. Incredible.
Awesome. You know, it's eventually going to happen. Might as well make this the year, right?
Why not? Let's go.
So much more to come on the campaign, but we want to bring it up with the new slogan, something to kind of think about as we head into that. And of course, the pickleball tournament to kick the whole thing off. There's one other event that we want to talk about, and that is the return of Barrels and Bids. So tell us more about this.
Yeah. So last year, Barrels and Bids was our events committee's little brainchild, but it was an inaugural event to celebrate 70 years of impact in Hancock County. It was a roaring success. It was wonderful. It was an incredible evening. And it was so powerful that we're deciding to bring it back again this year.
Sure.
So it's going to become an annual event for us. And that is September 17th from 6 to 9 at the Findlay Country Club. More details to come about that as that happens. But we do have some sponsorship opportunities that are available. So if anybody is interested, they can reach out to me at 419-423-1432.
And of course, put it on your calendar right now. And again, more details to come. So we're celebrating 71 years this time with Barrels and Bids.
Yeah.
Again, United Way Resource Development Director Kaya Yeader is with us this morning. Again, more information on all of this at the website and at the Facebook page. Where do we find you online?
Yeah, so our Facebook is United Way of Hancock County and our website is uwhancock.org.
The United Way of Hancock County in the spotlight this morning. Kaya, thanks very much.
Thank you so much.
The Community and Business Spotlight is a promotional advertisement paid for by the featured sponsor.
And that will finish up our podcast for today. I want to thank all of our guests for joining us on the program this morning. Remember, you can get more information about all of the topics that we talk about each and every day on the show at our webpage. That is goodmornings.net, where you can also sign up for our daily newsletter. You can reach out to us via email, more, connect with us on social media. Again, goodmornings.net is our little corner of the World Wide Web. Also, if you're a regular listener to the podcast, we would appreciate it if you would take a moment or two when you get a chance and leave us a rating or review on your favorite podcasting platform. That will help others discover the show as well. And we thank you very much for that. So until tomorrow morning, that is Good Mornings for this morning. Now that you've had a good morning, go on out and make it a good day. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.